You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is being recorded July 30th, 2025. And this, the war between Thailand and Cambodia, such as it is, I dealt with Thai politics many times in the past, Burmese politics. I'm very careful to pick my battles here. But I've written on Thailand several times before. In fact, the last time I spoke on it was 2020. Doesn't feel that way. But so I've radically updated my paper from that era. Given what's happened since then, it's extremely important. Remember, Southeast Asia is of immense importance. The U.S. sought though in the Vietnam War, the entire Asian economic bloc melted down because of the Soros and Thailand. And it's painful to see, of course, the instant experts out there. I actually went through some of these, it's not even mainstream journalists, but these, just these guys on YouTube, geopolitics something or whatever it is. And they do nothing but repeat each other with very little of substance, with very little, insight. And it's painful. It hurts. To see that. But the title of this Daily Nationalist is that it's time for another royalist coup in Thailand. We're going to talk about the economic impact of the reappearance of the oligarchy, the westernized oligarchy in that country. Now, I'm not sure why, though, but the media is very concerned with what so far has been a minor fight between Cambodia and Thailand. Few days ago, Cambodia, the military, the economy, Thailand is a first world country, Cambodia is a third. Cambodia's military and economy is a tenth of that, and that's being very generous of Thailand. To claim that any of this was over a border dispute or a temple is to be absurd. It's a typical media ignorance. Back in 2020, I dealt with the Thai oligarchy, and in fact back then, it was the failed color revolution that the U.S. tried to promote there after the military coup and the tremendous economic growth in that period of time. Hun Sen in Cambodia is not an oligarch, but since 2023, Thailand has again come under the rule of the plutocracy in a very obnoxious way. Oligarchy in Thailand doesn't even try to hide itself. It's so blatant. The prime minister who just was put on leave they're not even hiding their stupidity. They're just putting, their kids there in very powerful positions. And of course, this war is to some extent a part of that. But the corruption is so blatant that it requires a huge investment from the West to maintain any hold on power. The color revolution that sputtered was in 2019-2020. Today, though, actually it was 2023, in a no doubt a rigged election, the oligarchs took over. The Thai military in that period of time really tilted more towards China. The economy was focused more towards China. The U.S. was trying to weaken Chinese influence in Southeast Asia by financing liberal groups among the elite in Thai cities, and more importantly, overthrow the monarchy. The monarchies in both Cambodia and Thailand have similar powers, or a lack of powers, but in Thailand, you know, given what happened in, you know, the Vietnam era in Cambodia, the Thai monarchy has, I think, far more influence over society. It seems that liberalism, oligarchy, plutocracy, the hatred of China, that goes together in Southeast Asian life. There's no doubt in my mind that the border conflict, as they call it, against Third World Cambodia is connected to the reappearance of the Thai oligarchy. Now, from 2006 to 2000, you know, almost really till to the elections, there were protests against the military, military-allied state that was controlled entirely by USAID, and a handful of Thai billionaires with unpronounceable names provide much of the funding on the ground, very similar to what happened in Hong Kong a few years ago. Now, we know the West, the U.S. in particular, is in control here, and their NGOs, and the smoking gun is the sudden and bizarre insistence on things like gay rights and free access to abortion. That movement suddenly demands it. That has no basis of support in Thailand. That was never part of the initial reasons for any protest one way or the other. It comes from the U.S. and the NGOs, and it's obviously been shoehorned into Thai politics. Thing is, both Thailand and Cambodia are heavily dependent on China. Maybe dependent is too strong of a word. China is the most important trading partner of both of those countries. Cambodia, even more so. China is Thailand's largest foreign investor. Thailand has been struggling to maintain its first world status. And to the extent that the oligarchy holds on to power, that may collapse. Thailand, as you know, just very recently is now a member of BRICS, knowing full well that its future is in the East, not the West. China is far more of a stable partner compared with the unstable, ideologically motivated and deceitful Western elites, especially in the U.S. Andrew Koripko wrote just a few days ago, July 24th, he said, Cambodia is China's top partner in ASEAN, with ties being so close that rumors have swirled for years that China is plotting in secret to set up a naval base there, claims that both sides have denied. What China is doing, however, is building a canal in Cambodia to alleviate its import and export dependence on the Mekong River, whose mouth is controlled by the on-again, off-again rival Vietnam. Secret naval base? I don't think Cambodia owes anyone an explanation. China's going to host who it pleases, as it turns out. At least as far as the Cambodian government's concerned, it's a free port. I'm not even sure it's a naval base. But while the military was in power, or their party, their pro-military, pro-monarchist parties were in power, Thailand has been replacing its aging American military hardware with Chinese models, starting roughly in 2018. They're both less expensive and of higher quality. Because of its connection to ASEAN, Thailand was somewhat of an American client, going back a few decades, really going back as far as the Vietnam War. Thailand and China are working together to develop new delivery methods, the DTI-1 multi-rocket launcher and things like that, new helicopters, both of Russian and Chinese design. The Royal Thai Army used to use the U.S. Blackhawks, but they've been replaced by the MI-17. It's really a revolution in Thai military life. China and the U.S. don't produce interchangeable weapon systems. It's either one or the other. The American response, back then and now, but certainly back then, has been both typical and deceitful. Now, this is prior to the oligarchs being put back into power. Tony Cordellucci, who I trust in these matters, said, "To counter this tilt to China, the U.S. has mobilized opposition groups and NGOs that has funded in Thailand for years now to demand the current government step down and the nation's constitution rewritten, paving the way for a U.S.-backed billionaire-led opposition parties. The two men, Thaksin Shinawatra and Thanatorn Wangungrankit, into power. These are the opposition parties that have long served U.S. interests in the past and have explicitly promised to roll back Thai-Chinese relations should they take power again, and they have." I'm just pronouncing these names phonetically. In 2022, the CIA, a large CIA delegation, visited Bangkok. God knows what they did there. And it was about a huge number of military and other business deals meant to lure Thailand into the American orbit. Whether that went through or not is another matter. It's not no accident that the elections, won by the oligarchs, very unpopular people, occurred the following year. Thailand's prized by China. It's a first world country and it enjoys access to the Gulf of Thailand, which opens to the South China Sea. Now, there's far more connection between the U.S. Navy and the Thai Royal Navy. That goes back a long way, even the SEALs. A lot of Thais are trained in American academies. They go through BUDS training and stuff like that. Back in 2019, the U.S. Navy was training them in anti-sub warfare, despite the fact that they were purchasing Chinese Yuan-class submarines. Same time, the Air Chief Marshal, Napajay Dupatimian, wanted to buy 8 Lockheed Martin F-35 stealth combat jets, replace their aging F-5s and F-16s. Now, this is back in 2022. And he said, well, the F-35, they're no longer out of reach because the price was lowered from $142 million to $82 million apiece. In other words, the U.S. was desperately trying to unload these planes and undercut the Chinese. Now, they have the most elite air force in the region. And I question whether any country can have an air force that's, you know, half Russian, half U.S., half Chinese, half Western. But don't forget, one of the signs of a first world country is that they have their own domestic military-industrial complex. Cambodia does not. So these are purchases on the fringes. Now, the present war, since both countries have substantial ties with China, the war itself can't be said to be against China one way or the other. From the American view towards Thailand, the general policy is to rip both from the Chinese, especially Thailand. But the result of this would be to make them both, well, especially Thailand, an impoverished part of the American empire. A lot of Trump's tariff threats may have the effect of a Southeast Asia entirely without American influence, which is a wonderful thing. Back in 2020, the U.S. was determined to overthrow the government, and Thai protest leaders flew to Washington and Hong Kong to receive aid and directives. The oligarchs do the same. They're a little bit more arrogant, but they also have some trepidation. Now, as always, liberals, oligarchs, in any country, they have very few ties to their own home country. But at the same time now, their country is sort of at war with Cambodia, a country that Thais look down on. Much of the media in Thailand is owned by Western investors or local lackeys. But they're certainly opposing outlets, and they're popular. Thai protest leaders after the coup usually speak English and, as always, educated in the U.S. or Britain. The relation to Thailand is racial, and even that's tenuous since a lot of them are Chinese, or at least most partially Chinese. Because of this level of corruption and support from foreigners, things like the Future Forward Party had been banned, but they simply changed their name. So Thanathorn and Shinawatra. That was the prime minister the military overthrew in 2014 under CIA auspices. Joined forces, of course. Thanathorn, former UN employee, born into wealth. He said in an interview that he reads the New York Times, The Economist, and the Financial Times for his information. So English is his main language. They finance groups with bizarre names like the Assembly of the Poor and other beyond deceptive. They've hired the best New York PR firms to handle the optics of these spontaneous demonstrations a few years ago and attacks on the monarchy. But when the coup ousted him from power, Thaksin has been represented by the most elite PR firms and corporations on the planet. But now he's back, the war's begun. Now, specifically the lobbying firms, Kenneth Edelman of Edelman PR, James Baker III of Baker Botts Law Partners, and most recently, Robert Amsterdam of Amsterdam & Partners Law Firm, through their media and reputation management section. They're law firms in a manner of speaking. Since international law isn't normal, there's no sanction, there's no court structure, it's just a matter of leveraging power. But leveraging power is what oligarchs do. The oligarchs, Western ties, they're foreigners in essence, minimal ties to their home countries. Though I always thought it was interesting, and I said this back in 2020, Thaksin had his education, of course, in the U.S., but he has a doctorate in criminology from Sam Houston University. Nothing wrong with Sam Houston, it's all the same. It's just an odd place for a billionaire to go. And he receives his M.A. in the same subject from Eastern Kentucky. Nothing wrong. Graduate education is identical to any accredited institution, just doesn't seem like normal choices for billionaires. They go to Yale, Harvard, Georgetown, given the heavy elite and long-standing intelligence presence. Something like Warren Buffett going to Baikalsky State University of Economics and Law in Siberia to get an MA in sociology. Nothing wrong with it, but I can't picture him doing it. But regardless of whether they go to the Ivy League, it's a means whereby they're initiated into the intelligence services, broadly speaking, and then sent back. Thanathorn attended the University of Nottingham in the UK as well as NYU. And these are some of the most corrupt people on the planet. They don't even hide it. Tax breaks for his companies, doing everything they can to destroy their competition. He was convicted of a whole bunch of these things in 2008, very similar to what Navalny was convicted of in Russia. The West, having really no knowledge of what happened, the details, immediately condemns the conviction, paints him as a champion of free speech. The moment he's given any power, he begins arresting any opposition in the media. And given the long string of these almost children in the prime minister's office, their opponents tend to end up dead or in prison. This is why the Thai military ousted him. The popular coup in 2008 and again in 2014. Rightly saying that these men, corruption, nepotism, interference in state agencies, insults to the king, vote buying, plans to provoke violence, weakening of the army, and all of this was true. Clearly in his interest and on brand for all of them. The army was very clear. Issued a dossier on the necessity of the coup, including his impact on the collapse of public morals, violations of basic liberties, unnecessary social division. Of course, the coup was greeted with mass support, as most coups are. But I want to take a second here, and I've said this before. Few realize that the world's armies have very little interest in taking political power. The academics, any academics listening to this, would pay attention. They have very little interest in taking power. They normally work 12-hour days in their present capacity as defenders of the nation. And in Thailand, the Thai army has a lot of internal security issues and construction. They're not just for defense. And they're revered there. Surrounded by hostile, well-armed powers in Asia, they're on alert at all times. They're well aware that politics weakens the army tactically, but adds immeasurably to their already immense workload. They're all aware of this. They don't take over governments unless they're provoked beyond endurance. Or they're, like Pinochet was asked by the parliament to take over in Chile. Political power is hardly in the interest of high-ranking officers. Despite it being fairly obvious, it's not mentioned anywhere. The army moved when it thought there was no other option. Head of government from 2014 to the elections of 2023 was General Prayuth Chan-o-cha. The U.S. was heavily involved in his demise. In May of 2023, Thailand's Western Finance Opposition, the Move Forward Party, and the Phu Thai Party, won, in quote, the general election, despite only receiving 36% of the popular vote. August 22nd of that year, Thevasin of Phu Thai became Thailand's new prime minister, and that's when Shinawatra returned to Thailand after years of self-imposed exile, because he's a drama queen. But the only way they could form a government is to convince, there's a lot of parties there, to convince many other parties to join them, which means it has to be a lot of money spread around. Now, Pita Jim Jirat, or something like that, 44-year-old billionaire, became a leader of the Move Forward Party. Move Forward replaced the Future Forward. Because of corruption, they've been dissolved by the Supreme Court. Of course, educated in the U.S., Harvard and Texas Austin, among other places. I mean, these are the worst. These are the sons of rich people. He returns to Thailand in 2005, took over his family's rice bran oil company, produced nothing on his own. But in 2019, he was approached by the Future Forward Party to be a candidate for the general election of that year. He accepted, and the oligarchs installed him in the House of Representatives. 2020, that party was dissolved, but he still was there to lead the next party, despite having zero political experience. He was just a figurehead, obviously. He has been groomed for a long time to be the face of the Thai oligarchy, despite being mostly Chinese. And he clearly is more comfortable in Boston than Bangkok. Because he says stupid things like, the reason I became a politician was he was inspired by the example of Barack Obama. An obvious lie. Used to ensure his support from the West. No, he's been groomed for this. He is a billionaire's kid, a billionaire himself. The minute he landed in the U.S., he was already involved with Thai and American economic elites. He had done nothing except being born into that family. You know, the biographies of these rich kids, they're always strange. They're always very disjointed. They sound almost made up. Like a very rough draft of a spy novel. They go from one unearned position to the next without experience or knowledge or even understanding of what they're doing. But for billionaires and their kids, it's common. It's expected. Nothing these people have received is from merit. Only that he has money and he is easily pliable. And that creates monsters. Worse than that, though, he runs the media in Thailand from his father. And that really brought him into tremendous opposition with the monarchists and the militarists and the nationalists. He was suspended from being a member of parliament because he was using his broadcast platform, ITV, for partisan purposes. All English language media there is owned by the oligarchy along with Western investors. Last I checked, about 44-45% of Thais speak English. But the Thai law is very clear. Politicians may not own shares in media enterprises for obvious reasons. Then he says, well, it didn't produce any media content of note, but it's a lie. The regime says that and had him say that because it was no longer on the Thai stock exchange, somehow it was thus defunct. The stratospheric levels of corruption and manipulation, mobilizing foreign powers to overthrow the monarchy, it's been the goal of the oligarchs since the 1930s. This has been remember, Thailand was never a colony. They have an old history going back to Siam. But he thought he was invincible and he lost. He merely transferred shares of the non-existent, quote-unquote, media company to his family members and certain restrictions have been lifted. Now, there were some legitimate protests. But in this particular case, a handful of protesters, when he got kicked out, a handful of protesters were outside the legislative chambers, protest signs, all in English. Again, because of the percentage, I want to be fair about that. But still, it's clear they weren't appealing to ordinary times. He was forbidden from becoming prime minister in 2023. He immediately flew to the U.S. to plan out his next moves. You know, because he's been given everything, he has such a distorted picture of the world. He has no conception of what it's like to be just an ordinary human being. He has no experience in Thai governance, no right to become a legislator. His family's media empire and these other assets have given him his position, not to mention foreign pressure. So once he was removed from parliament for all of the media corruption, his backers and family sent him on a tour of universities and institutes around the world where he condemned the Thai state and, of course, was treated as a statesman. He has done nothing without the support and explicit backing of Western powers, not to mention his own billions. And then he was banned from politics for 10 years. It's like in Syria. You change the group's name and put some new people on the board, and it's meant to circumvent the law or sanction. He was succeeded by a very bratty 35-year-old, Nathafong Ruingpanyawut, who also inherited his wealth from his father, a real estate tycoon, a luxury housing company, was where he made his billions. I doubt he has ever met or even seen a poor Thai, unless they came to work on his Bugatti. Again, someone with zero experience in political life and inherited wealth is meant to lead a major party in Thailand at the behest of Washington. My orange cat Stanley the Manly Jr. has as much right to rule Thailand as these guys do. The media called him a tech whiz because he graduated with a degree in computer science, but he's not involved in that field. They called him that many times. Although he was careful not to leave Thailand for his education, he went to the Chulalongkorn University, very selective, the dominant university in Thailand, but an academic institution created by the Rockefeller Foundation, which financed and staffed the school, providing it with this academic foundation many years ago. And of course, his connections haven't ceased. It gets worse. Now, she's been suspended. But this is the worst of all. The country was run by another very spoiled oligarch brat, Pantugarn Shinawatra, the youngest child of Thaksin Shinawatra. Somehow, she's a prime minister under the Few Thai Party. Educated in Surrey, England, with a master's degree in hotel management, somehow, through zero merit of her own. She's the largest shareholder in SC Asset Corporation, director of the Thaicom Foundation. As of 2022, she holds a total of 21 companies valued at roughly $2 billion, 68 billion baht. And it's typical, you know, she wasn't a very good, she's decent looking. I don't know if you've seen pictures of her, the one that was just kind of forced out. She's decent looking, even as she got older. She's 35 or something. Her GPA in high school is like 2.5. No way you're going to get into Chulalongkorn University with that. Turns out, she received copies of her entrance exams early. In other words, she cheated. And she kind of got caught because her second attempt had a score much higher than the first one. But, you know, no one was shocked at this. I don't even think she needed it in the first place. The problem, of course, is that with all these brats, these ignoramuses, children of rich kids, Thaksin Shinawatra, the oligarch, the Boris Berezovsky of Thailand, continues to rule and Thailand remains an oligarchy. Now, there was a vote of no confidence which she survived, alleging that she has making the obvious statement that she has allowed her father to control the Thai government. She has no autonomy to run the country, which is an obvious truth, but probably a good thing because she doesn't know anything. That explains her absurd phone call to Cambodia's Hun Sen, got this crisis started. In that phone call, she told the Cambodian leader, she tried to cozy up to him. I think she's used to that with men, powerful men. No doubt she used her looks. There's no doubt in my mind. And I think this is how she normally operates, cozying up to him. And said that the commander of the 2nd Army Region, which, by the way, is on the border with Cambodia, is our mutual opponent. That plays a huge role in the present conflict. She knew enough, though, to march in the Bangkok Pride Parade in 2023, financed by the UN, and they forced fag marriage through the legislature in January of 2025, despite zero popular support in the country. There are protests against her, and they are not backed by the regime, God knows. She's told what to say. Of course, her first priority, other than that, is debt restructuring. We know what that means. It's another term for austerity under the IMF. There is no conceivable way she has much support in the country. It should shock no one that she also is a proponent of the legalization of gambling casinos in Thailand, because that's what an indebted country needs. That if the oligarchs stay in power much longer, Thailand will become a third world state. And the PR and law firms that I mentioned above, they have specialized counsel in this regard, especially when it comes to debt restructuring. So she's in a kind of administrative leave, given that overly friendly phone call. It just shows you she doesn't know anything. Some other guy with an impossible to pronounce name, acting as prime minister, deputy prime minister, Wang Rung Grunkit. It's because she didn't know how to, doesn't know anything about politics. She didn't know how to act in a phone call to a world leader. All she knows is how to be liked, to charm men more powerful than herself. That's how she's acted her whole life. That's all she knows how to do. In the vote of no confidence, one of the main reasons in the document was her lack of knowledge and experience. In the meantime, her coalition partners are abandoning her, and her approval rating is 9%. And dropping. None of these people were legitimately elected. But none of this oligarchic nepotism is new. This is why militaries take over. It shows the cluelessness of the world's professors and journalists. Back in 2019, the protests against the pro-military government were termed by the Western media as student-led and spontaneous. The same articles from both elite media and official public intellectuals are published year after year, just changing the names and the locations. Same cliches are used for every color revolution by the Western press, using Western corporate NGOs as sources. They use coded terms like civil society, democratic opposition, spontaneous protest, independent media, student-led, stuff like that. They're used in the same manipulative way over and over again. But in the end, they all refer to the rule of liberal, wealthy oligarchs, connected with the Americans, the lifeblood of globalism. They're revolutionary, certainly. Their centers are in New York and Washington. All of these people that I've mentioned, their connections to Thailand are minimal. It was USAID, Goldman Sachs, Boeing, for reasons we've already mentioned why Boeing's involved. They finance the groups from country to country without fail, certainly in this case, too. In this case, the point is to westernize Thailand, take over her educational, labor, media, political worlds, turning them into copies of the USA, destroying their identity to be used as a source of wealth to finance the debt of a dying and overstretched US empire. And, of course, in the process, tear Bangkok away from Beijing. I think last time I spoke about this, I mentioned two front groups that these people put together. Thai Lawyers for Human Rights is my favorite. It receives 100% of its funding from the EU, Germany, NGOs from the US, UK, Canada. So a group pretending to be the representative of Thai nation actually receives none of its support from people living in Thailand. If journalists couldn't get any lower and more stupid, back at this point, when the protests were going on, 1920, journalists were claiming that a major protest was, quote, organized by secondary school children. In fact, I even have when I published this article, I have the link to it. This is odd because it had expensive staging, sleek graphic design, sophisticated ideological uniformity, mediated by American social media platforms controlled by others, protest signs in English, meaning that it's for Western audiences. I always thought it was strange, though. I went through... the website is mostly in English, but when you go to the Thai and you use Google Translate, there's a huge number of articles about children being used in protests and how to legally defend them. I found that very strange. Clearly it's a strategy, and more than one. Far more than a normal person would think you would have there. ILAW is another group. Zero roots in Thailand. Their own website, they I don't think they even have a Thai section of their website. They say they're funded by the U.S. government via the NED, the Open Society Foundation, Fund for Global Human Rights, the American Jewish World Service, Google. This is what independent means to them. The American NED owned website back then. No, tried on its website that it receives over 1.5 million Thai baht a year from Washington. And it also says, here's its purpose. To foster public understanding and dialogue on the impact of existing and new laws on civil and political rights and to promote freedom of expression. The organization will monitor and assess the political and governance processes, as well as the various laws inherited from the military government, and provide the public with accessible analysis of their impact on citizens' rights. Will also operate a documentation center to monitor and report on freedom of expression violation. Will collaborate with other civil society groups in advocating for democracy and human rights. They use this kind of language, the same stilted, nonsensical, formulaic language. And we'll talk about the monarchy here in a second. Is this worthwhile? Now, I have to admit, on this site, I did find a couple of pictures with protesters with signs in Thai. In Thai, I couldn't believe it. But they were a minority. Again, let me quote Tony Quadalucci. And this is a few years ago, prior to 2023. Western media functions more as lobbyists or even foreign intelligence agencies, rather than actual journalists, by deliberately omitting facts, fabricating others, and all to ensure maximum momentum of what verified U.S. political interference in a foreign country. As the Western media had done during the opening phases of the now admittedly U.S.-engineered Arab Spring in 2011, it is again attempting to lie about opposition movements across Asia, attempting to oust pro-Chinese governments in favor of those that will bolster U.S. primacy in the Asia-Pacific region. Not a whole lot of real foreign correspondence left anymore. There's a mainstream media is struggling. None of these guys have any specialized knowledge on these topics. Johnson's Law was formulated by a very attractive, well-known historian to reflect these facts. In a similar area, by the way, was Burma that got it started. There's so few to contradict the distortions and lies in the media from obscure places like this. The media... These empires are losing money, circulation, and respect. They're not going to spend a small fortune to send an experienced journalist across the world. So what they do, the young guys, they sit in D.C. and New York, they simply call Amnesty International, watch CNN, or contact the liberal Thai group in the West. And that's their sources. Military and the crown. That's the locus of patriotic and nationalist ideology in the country. They're revered institutions. The crown is a visible and ancient reminder of tradition. After the coup, they drafted a long constitution that was approved by 62% of Thai voters. That was in 2016. About 60-65% of the voting public turning out. The name that they took was the National Council of Peace and Order. That was the name of the military government. The pro-military and royalist party, Palang Parakath, Pray Charkath, I don't know what the hell it is, pro-military and royalist party. Initially, they won 115 out of 500 seats in the legislature. Very large, 500 in 2019, despite a massive media campaign against them. Thailand, unlike the U.S., has many, many, many parties, so 115 seats is very impressive. None of these generals have been given financial empires. They went up the ranks like any other soldier. They come normally from the lower classes. Their contempt for these rich kids is beyond computation. 2023, the rule of the oligarchs, money coming in, huddled out that party to the point where it won only 40 seats, although there are many pro-military and pro-royal parties in Thailand. Again, because Thailand was never a colony, the army and crown then and now are seen as guarantors of independence and sovereignty. The royalist and nationalist movement, which the army is a part, is populist. It promotes investment in cheap housing, working class debt relief, which is a big deal there, increasing the minimum wage, reinforcing payments for newborns and mothers, your typical social nationalist kind of things. The very opposite of what the IMF demands from its clients, what the recently disgraced Prime Minister Airhead wanted to promote. If Thailand is brought into the Great Reset the way that these people want, it will no longer be a first world country. It will be a debt colony producing raw materials. Army and the monarchy are all that stand in the way. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention 1997, because that's very relevant to what's happening. I was in grad school at the time, and the East Asian economies, for lack of a better word, melted down. Although only those that had a non-state-controlled central bank. Ultimately, it was started by George Soros' firm, speculating on the Thai currency, shorting it, actually. The Thai currency is a baht, B-H-A-T, from London. Thailand was devastated. Much of Asia went into a meltdown. The Asian tigers became prosperous because they were under military governments. The U.S. did not support them. They didn't like them. So, 96-97, Soros entered Thailand with his quantum fund. He saw overvalued stock, rapid growth. He had a large amount of investment liquidity. He borrowed billions of baht from various Thai banks. Then he quickly sold them for dollars. Now, at that time, there was a fixed exchange rate between the baht and the dollar. It was 1 to 25. Of course, any rapidly growing economy, you're going to have asset bubble. That kind of gave him his in. This is why many investors sold their Thai currency holdings. That ratio couldn't hold and eventually went to 1 to 40 or higher even. In a classical shorting scheme, for those of you who don't know, and it's hard. It's a very Jewish concept. Soros only needed to exchange some of his dollars for the borrowed baht and return it to Thailand. By shorting, it just means that Soros borrowed Thai currency at an earlier, stronger rate. $1 to 25 baht. Well, when the baht went to 154, $1.54 baht a few months later, Soros then traded the 1 billion. You know, he had more than that, but $1 billion for 54 billion baht in the spot market. He used his forward contracts to change the 54 billion baht into $2 billion, doubling his money. He did the same thing to the British pound in 92. Not to mention, a lot of his media, as well as liberal media in Western media in Thailand, were convincing people that the currency was unstable, get rid of it. It was run on the banks. But the important thing to take from this is that this is liberalism. It's associated in Thailand with these events, as it should be. This is economic terrorism. He's also financing some of these protests. The West is doing all it can to tear what is a prosperous, traditionalist, very proud nation because it's never been a colony surrounded by countries who have been. The yellow shirts were the big pro-royal protesters. They have rallies in the capital numbering in the hundreds of thousands. So to think that the Royalist Party's only got, 40 seats is laughable. Now, the monarchy is under attack because it usually backs the military. It remains very popular, always will. King Rama IX, one of the longest reigning monarchs in world history, died in 2016. The concept of monarchy is very well developed there. On their website, they answer a lot of the questions about it. Despite the fact that it is a constitutional monarchy, it does have some political... One of the big things it could do is issue pardons. I should have mentioned that before. They say the Thai monarchy has a unique quality, adaptability, and change. It's enabled it to flourish to this day. It has always shown exceptional compassion, relevance, and vitality, particularly in the contemporary world. Well, the crown, the royal family, through its assets, private assets, has spent a fortune on an infrastructure project out of its own pocket. They've alleviated rural poverty. They've built complex, expensive irrigation projects. They've forgiven billions in rural debt. You had somewhat of a drug problem, nothing like, Afghanistan, or the crown has financed replacement crops for the opium poppies in those same areas. Again, part of the reason that the military and the monarchy has to go in the West Mine. Now, he says he's committed to the development of democratic principles, but that doesn't mean anything. He is, however, a populist. The political stability, which has played an essential part in Thailand's remarkable economic growth over the past decade, has been largely due to the fact that the leaders of all factions share a deep respect of his, that is, the monarchy's views in such matters, especially when Rama was alive. The monarchy, no matter what it is, its very existence is a threat to liberalism. A monarchy is anti-liberal by definition. European liberalism was formulated exactly against monarchy and overthrew them or reduced them to figurehead. The crown, even without necessarily a mandate to do so, it did punish corrupt bureaucrats and bankers, especially those who moved too slowly in financing development projects in the poorer north of the country. Rama IX was the most traveled monarch in Thai history for that very reason. Now, for a while, it hasn't come up recently, but the West wants the monarchy gone. And when the military was in power, the oligarchs issued a list of very deceitful demands on reforming the monarchy. The theory is that in breaking the locus of tradition, liberalism will more easily be able to take over. It's based on the archetypal glorious revolution of early modern England. This movement against the crown is about as Thai as hot dogs are. This is a list of demands against it. Revoke the king's immunity against lawsuits. Revoke Les Majestés the law giving amnesty to every persecuted individual. Les Majestés, insulting the king. Separate the king's personal and royal assets. Reduce the budget allocated to the monarchy. Abolish the royal offices and unnecessary units like the Privy Council. Open assets of the monarchy to audit. Cease the king's power to give public political comments. Cease propaganda around the king. Investigate the murders of commenters and critics of the monarchy. That's projection. Forbid the king to endorse future coups, military coups. Now, if that went through, that would reduce the monarchy to a tourist attraction. That means that the left sees him as the font of resistance against Western capital. Once he's gone, there could be a purge of the army, patriots, and royalists. Now, when they say cease propaganda around the king, it's coded, since in practice, it would mean their takeover of all media to shut down any pro-royal stories and essays. That's what that actually means. It's a massive censorship demand made in the language of a free press. Forcing the king to stay silent on politics, the name of free speech, is a mockery, but most color revolutions are. Taking the crown's assets is a way to engorge the oligarchs who run the movement, and then render the crown unable to defend itself from the lawsuits the first man above would legalize. That's why some of these parties were liquidated. They seek to make Thailand a colony of the U.S. and the EU, and they should be liquidated as a result of it. But over time, Thailand has left or moved away from the ASEAN, which was supposed to be the Southeast Asian NATO, and plugged its very advanced economy into China. You know, this, I described the Soros meltdown that occurred. You know, really showed itself like in 1998. That led, with one of the reasons, one of the things that led to the Chinese Belt and Road response. The point is to insert Thai capital into the Great Reset, liquidating them into BlackRock Holdings. Of course, Thai firms can't compete with any of that. Unfortunately, as of now, the Bank of Thailand is privately owned. But the state, whether military or otherwise, is constantly warring with it, trying to bring it under the control, its control, especially after the coup. It had far more state control after the coup. Now, the Cambodian State Bank is 100% state-owned. That's why it was basically unaffected by the meltdown since 1997. Although things like, you know, the collapse of the market and stuff like that certainly affected it. One of the key battles in the Thai Central Bank between the oligarchs' need for rapid returns, you know, the short-term thinking, versus the long-term needs of the country. So now we're seeing even the oligarchs trying to control the central bank when it suits them. Looks like they've placed Vittai Ratanankom as chairman of the Bank of Thailand. And it means that the short-term idea has at least taken over the bank, it was, I think, a week ago, to cut rates. So that faction of the plutocracy can weaponize the bank against their competitors, both domestic and otherwise. Unfortunately, tied to household debt is about 90% of GDP, the highest in all of Southeast Asia. Well, as I've said, the result the 1997 meltdown was the Belt and Road Project. It was first considered roughly around 2000, but officially implemented around 2013. Thailand was critical. Thailand and Cambodia were both critical. And we don't know what that is. It's a multi-trillion dollar long-term project to redraw much of the world's economy on a national and regional basis. It's anti-liberal. For example, the high-speed rail project under construction connecting China, Laos, and Thailand. Now, normally I wouldn't give a damn about high-speed rail connecting China, Laos, and Thailand, but it's intensely symbolic here. It's a very anti-colonial shift of the Asian economy. Now, criticism for the network, these transportation projects, just like the criticism of the Belt and Road itself, comes from bitter American elites who are very worried about China, having long surpassed the U.S. economically, and are restructuring the Asian economy. Voice of America, which, by the way, is owned by Soros's, one of Soros's companies, they always are pushing neurotic projections, Beijing employing debt-trap diplomacy. Laos, don't forget, is landlocked, but so they admit that, yes, they could benefit from this. It shows you the differences between a social nationalist mentality and the capitalist mentality. As of now, Laos, very third world, can't pay for this massive infrastructure project, the rail or anything else. But that's not the point. You have to have that in place for future economic growth to take place. That's why the state is involved. That's why investing in infrastructure is absolutely essential. That's why the state has to be strong here. Joseph Thomas wrote in Asia-Pacific Research. Initially, he said, low ridership was seized upon by the Western media claiming China's HSR ambitions were too big and the entire project was in trouble, as one Business Insider op-ed did in 2011. Now, in 2021, Western pundits, despite China State Railway overseeing the nation's HSR network, regularly turning an annual profit, still lecture China over the HSR, high-speed rail, after over a decade of predicting its failure. That never materialized. It's like a form of political manifesting, you know, Oprah talks about. If you repeat something over and over again and you truly believe it will happen, it'll make it a reality. Pretty much that's all the regime has left. It's what the libertarians don't understand, though. Infrastructure comes first, then prosperity comes afterwards. Well, the American infrastructure is falling apart. That's especially true for third world states like Cambodia or Laos. But because those projects don't have an immediate payout or profit, Americans claim it's a failure. Which is part of the reason that infrastructure in the U.S. is long stalled. It's falling apart and the funding has stalled. American elites have no conception of a long-term strategy or the actual production of physical goods. They're foreign concepts to Western capitalists. Thomas continues. He says, for the West, tangible jealousy in manifesting itself as China builds infrastructure out of reach of even the richest Western nations. You see nations like Laos and Thailand share in China's rise seems to pain many in the West even more. Many in the West who see their culture and system as superior, yet finding increasingly difficult to explain why Asia as a whole appears to be surpassing the West by a growing number of metrics. Well, of course, that was written in 2021. But China, let alone all of Southeast Asia, has surpassed the U.S. as the world's largest economy when you use PPP aggregate numbers. Purchasing power parity, I've dealt with that already. Not to mention things like actual production. This is why the Western governments have mobilized and created these opposition groups in Thailand. The Belt and Road Initiative is a massive way to bring some common sense to international economy. It's why they want to overthrow the military, any royalist government. Because this is where the close and growing ties to China are coming from. That connection with China is going to bring increasing prosperity and independence to Thailand and elsewhere, and will further embarrass the regime, and so that brings us now to full circle. And Cambodia is no different. Cambodia is a little bit closer to China than Thailand is, but they're both very close. Cambodia has done fairly well under Hun Sen, but infrastructure is essential. Their industrial base is fairly weak, textiles, a few things like that. I read the Cambodia's industrial development policy, and a lot of, you know, weasel words and cliches, but China has to be an essential part of building this skill-based industry, as they say. They want to do it by 2025. Well, this is 2025. COVID did a number on them, despite not really having a lot of cases. And oh, by the way, Hun Sen in Cambodia, he was not impressed by the COVID thing. He did not really enforce the masks and all that nonsense. He got into trouble for it. He didn't care. They always had a very low number. I think by the time the regime shut down the global economy, Cambodia had 40 cases, 45 cases. And clearly, COVID, despite everything it did to the economy, pushed that target year back. What the Chinese are doing in partnership with these other countries, reducing transport, logistics costs, without imposing an ideology or a mentality, destroying traditional institutions like the monarchies or both countries, which the U.S. wants to do. A quote from a book on this question. By the end of 2017, more than 1,500 miles of roads, 7 large bridges, and a new container terminal at the Phnom Penh Autonomous Port have been constructed with support from China. Some mega infrastructural project which existed before the inception of the Belt and Road have been designated as MSRI projects. For example, the Phnom Penh Sihanoukville Expressway, the most important road connecting industrial zones in Phnom Penh to the seaport, is to be built and constructed by China Communications Construction Company. on something called a build-operate-transfer basis. Another important infrastructural project is the construction of Cambodia's first communication satellite, Techno One. The Royal Group, that was a local conglomerate, and the China Great Wall Industry Corporation are involved in that. So that's just an example. And the West, of course, what does it do? Attack and tries to destabilize the Belt program. The only way it could really do it is promoting these billionaires and their bratty kids. And as time goes on, their tactics will become more and more desperate. If China's regional ambitions are realized, and they pretty much have, this opposition is going to have no choice than to join up or just move to the U.S. or Britain. Clearly, the vast majority of people can see these tangible benefits. This is one thing that everyone can agree on, that these projects are necessary. The Thai military, as well as the Crown, realizes these oligarchs and these parties created by the NGOs move forward all this nonsense. It's to break up the ancient core of their country's existence. One of the ways that they have maintained their independence for centuries, the Crown, make inroads into the Buddhist culture there. The Less Majesty Law, protecting the monarchy. As I've already mentioned, it's a huge part of it. Move Forward won 151 seats in the 500-member parliament in May of 2023. You had 67 parties competing, but it couldn't form a coalition government. Their attacks on the monarchy went nowhere. And for the most part, the color revolution, at least back then, came to nothing. Some of these rich kids heard no for the first time because their parties had been dissolved. Their rule over the country is very tenuous. They're back, but it's a tenuous rule. You're not allowed to insult the monarchy. That's what that means. The Australian Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade had the gall to write this. Australia believes that inclusivity, pluralism, and freedom of expression are key democratic principles. These principles are not served by the dissolution of the Move Forward Party. That's the same country that sends people to prison for tweets cast out on official story of World War II, immigration, or the trannies. The EU sends hundreds of men to prison for stickers protesting the left. The EU has imprisoned nationalist leaders and liquidated any party that offends them. France, Moldova, Germany, Ukraine en masse, and Romania. But they have the gall to say that. It was important to analyze their demands concerning the monarchy, because in and of themselves, they sound harmless. They reduce the budget, all this kind of thing. But when you're at that level, when you're a billionaire, especially when you're a child of a billionaire, it's never enough. They do have tremendous assets, which they spend tremendously on the popular. We already talked about that. That's been one of the reasons why the monarchy is so popular. They want that for themselves. When you start talking about cease the king's power to give political comments, cease propaganda, etc. This is a mass censorship campaign. Everyone's allowed to have a political opinion but him. Large numbers of opponents of these oligarchs end up dead or in exile or in prison. So them talking about murders or imprisonment of opponents of the monarchy is nothing but projection. Censorship demand that somehow they've made in the name of a free press. This isn't Thai. This is purely American. Or Western, I should say. The oligarchs want to engorge themselves. So as it stands now, it looks like a perfect time for another coup d'etat. And eliminate these bratty kids once and for all. Kick them out of the country permanently. Make sure they're connected with the Chinese, the Russians, and the stupid war, which really only exists because of that airhead. you know, when you have her trying to say that, you know, our mutual enemy is the head of that particular military region, there's no way that's not relevant. And they're saying, if this woman doesn't know anything, what is she doing here? There's no way these people were legitimately elected. The massive amount of money that they had compared to their opponents. Massive media control compared to their opponents. Ballot stuffing and everything else compared to their opponents. This may well be a time. Maybe a very good time. The Army really would rather not do this, though. But now that there's some sort of a truce, I guess, maybe it's time. There's no real good reason for Cambodians and Thais to be killing each other. They're very different from each other. Thais do tend to look down on them. But there's far bigger fish to fry. Make sure to kick the Americans out and to have this girl come in here who's never heard the word no before, demanding austerity on the country. In other words, slashing welfare benefits and everything else. And of course, legalizing gambling. You know, because there's a lot of corruption in terms of the, on the border of Cambodia and Thailand. Her friends are heavily involved in that. That would be a huge windfall for her. Her own company she owns are a part of that. I don't know if she knows that or not, but it's true. If there's ever a good reason for a coup, it's now. And it's just been one idiot after another. I've listed them. I'm sure I butchered their names. I don't care. There's no way out of it. But it's been one brat after another. They're not even trying to hide the nepotism. These people don't know anything. They're hardly Thai. The NGOs are paying for protesters and voters. These are some of the most corrupt people in Southeast Asia, and that's saying something. I'm a monarchist and a nationalist, and Thailand is a great example of how the two work together extremely well and has kept that country independent for centuries. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion. Talk Radio for the Nationalist Community.